This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio at thepeoplespeakradio.net. This is your host, David Swanson, and we are going to be speaking for the next hour. You and me, all of us, call in and go to the chat room, and you can ask a question on any topic whatsoever. You can play Katie Couric tonight. We are going to be speaking with an exciting candidate for the United States Congress, different from the run-of-the-mill candidates we have out there. Gordon Clark, who is running as a Green Party candidate in the 8th District of Maryland. This is suburban Maryland, north of Washington, D.C. And Gordon is has been known to me and perhaps many of you for quite some time as an activist for peace and justice. And you can read his bio at thepeoplespeakradio.net or at clarkforcongress.net, C-L-A-R-K, clarkforcongress.net, which is his website, and it's one of the best campaign websites I have seen. His resume includes executive director of New Jersey Peace Action, national executive director of Peace Action, founder in 2002 of Iraq Pledge of Resistance, now called the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance, field director of Public Citizens Congress Watch, project coordinator for Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Here is someone whose resume would be absolutely scorned by Sarah Palin, but which stands out to me as what we might use on Capitol Hill these days. If you want to call in and ask Gordon Clark why he's running for Congress, how he can get elected, and what he thinks of what they're doing there right now, you can call us toll-free for the next hour anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. Anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. That's toll-free, 877-489-6350. Or go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and go to the chat room and send in your questions and I'll ask them. Gordon Clark, welcome to the People Speak Radio. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for having me. And I'm delighted if your listeners want to play Katie Couric, just so long as I don't have to play Sarah Palin.
Okay, well, let's see. Name a Supreme Court case you disagree with.
Dred Scott? I don't know. You want more reason than that?
Well, no. It's just that Sarah Palin couldn't, and it seems like a question that someone who's running for Congress or the vice presidency might be able to answer.
Yeah,
I'm glad
well,
that
there's
you...
an awful lot of questions she doesn't seem to be able to answer.
So tell me why you're running in the 8th District of Maryland, which
uh-huh.
is currently represented since 2003 by Chris Van Hollen, who's rather a rightward-leaning or centrist, as they would call it, leaning Democrat. He won with 77% of the vote last time, and a Green Party candidate got 1%. Prior to him, for many years, there was a perhaps slightly left-leaning Republican Congress member there, Connie Morella. So you look at this background and you think, well, why in the world would these people who vote for a centrist Republican and a centrist Democrat want a left-wing candidate? And then you go and look at the issues on your website, and they're all positions that strong majorities of Americans want, but most candidates don't talk about. how do we get at this situation, and how do you reach out to people in your district?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not unusual, and thank you for mentioning my history as an activist and organizer for peace and social justice and the environment. It's ironic and sometimes a little bit painful for those who are doing this work to realize that the positions that we advocate and fight for are, by and large, majority positions in this country. I mean, if you ask, you know, people things about war in Iraq or cutting military spending or a host of other issues, you will often find, you know, not only large percentages, but majorities of people agreeing with you. And yet, for some reason, these majority positions never seem to get enacted by our government, or, you know, whether it's the administration or the United States Congress. And, you know, at least part of the reason for that, and you were talking about Chris Van Hollen as being a centrist Democrat, I think what's more appropriate to call him, and what explains a little more, is that he has become a very corporate Democrat. In fact, in his few years, he's, as you've noted, he was elected in 2002, so he hasn't been there that long. But in his short stay, he has become one of the most corporative Democrats. He has now risen in this very short time to be the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He is one of the top fundraisers in the House of Representatives. And I think that goes a long way in explaining why, even though he portrays himself as very liberal, which is easy these days because all anyone has to do is attack President Bush and, you know, the public will perceive you as liberal, even though he likes to portray himself as very liberal or even progressive, in fact, he is very corporate, as evidenced by things like, you know, his positions on the war in Iraq, his positions on Afghanistan and Pakistan, his position on the financial bailout bill, all of which I'd be happy to speak about with you and your audience. So I think, you know, the reason that I've decided to do this, well, I mean, there are a few. One is that I have spent the past 25 or so years of my life as an organizer, as a policy advocate, as an activist. And, you know, I think at this point, the most effective thing I can do to try and produce change in our government, to try and produce change in the United States Congress, is to actually run for office and to reach out to people in ways that you really can't when you're doing, you know, advocacy work where, you know, for a large part of the time, you're kind of speaking to the committee, the people who are already receptive to your audience. And running in a political race, you have the opportunity to reach out to people all across the spectrum, like I was just an hour ago handing out brochures at a local metro stop. So people are receptive to hearing things in a way that they wouldn't normally be during the rest of the year, and in a way that they wouldn't be coming from just a one-issue advocacy group. So that's why I've chosen to do it, and the goal is really to change, again, the representation of this district. One of the things that I'm sure many of your listeners won't realize is that the 8th Congressional District of Maryland is one of the most progressive districts in the country. You know, when you get outside of Berkeley and areas like that, in certain parts of, you know, the Upper West Side of Manhattan, this is one of the most progressive districts in the country. And as I've been saying to people, we deserve to have one of the most progressive representatives in Congress, not the representative who's raising the most amount of money from corporate campaign contributions. And I think there's a real opening here, to be honest. I think, you know, in a way, as someone who's been tracking politics and involved in it for a lot of years, even if this is my first attempt at an electoral run, there's a real openness I sense this year to other messages. There's a lot of frustration with both parties. This financial bailout bill has definitely, a lot of people are like a pox on both their houses. They can't understand it. And so I think there's a real opening. And, you know, obviously, and I'll say this and then I'll stop. I don't want to filibuster you here in my opening comment.
But, oh, we want filibusters tonight in the Senate, too.
Yeah, right, in the Senate, exactly. You know, as I said, I do think there's a real opening, and, well, gosh, there, I lost my train of thought. I forget what
I'm
I was
sorry.
Going to end with. So why don't I just stop and feel free to ask another question.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Gordon, but I think you're right that there's an opening and that there is a pox on both their houses mood. Let me just ask you about this bailout bill for a second, because
sure.
Chris Van Hollen voted for this thing, to throw hundreds of billions of dollars at bankers with, you know, I mean, I think most of the listeners to this show have probably grasped that the sky is not about to fall, that the stock market and the actual real economy are not the exact same thing, and that this is an incredible giveaway to the people responsible for getting themselves into a fraudulent mess. But he voted for this. Do the people in your district support this bailout, or are they indifferent, or do they think that he's opposed us on this biggest giveaway of our money and our children's money ever, but he's a Democrat, so we should vote for him, or what is the mood you sense out there?
Well, they haven't done any polls specific to the 8th congressional district in Maryland on this, and the mood that I sense is, you know, what I hear when I talk to people, as I did today when I was leafleting a metro stop, what I hear on the local radio station, and all the things that I'm hearing are that people are very, very angry about this, that they get that there's something fundamentally wrong about it, and that, you know, even though something does need to be done, and I don't think we should minimize that. I mean, I do think there's a real issue here in terms of the credit markets and the ability of people who run small businesses and, you know, who are trying to get cars or do other things to get credit because of all these bad loans that are out there, that the credit market is sort of freezing up. So I would certainly say that something needs to be done. But what needs to be done is something very different than the bill that my opponent, Mr. Van Hollen, voted for, which is overwhelmingly a giveaway to very wealthy interests, to banks and others on Wall Street. And I think people sense that very clearly, and they're very angry about it. And they know that they're hurting right now, and they don't understand why the banks who got themselves into this trouble all by themselves are getting bailed out, while those of us on Main Street, as we like to say, are seeing nothing of it. So I do think that there are a few key issues in this. And by the way, for anyone who's interested, because there are a lot of details, obviously it's a complex issue, but I do have a fairly, what I hope is a thorough press release out explaining what the problem is with the current bill. And some of the, you know, the major things that they got wrong in the bill is in terms of who pays for this bailout. You know, why isn't more being done to get the money from the wealthiest Americans in terms of the people who benefited from the stock market rise, whether it's repealing tax cuts? Why isn't there a provision to put a very small 1% tax on securities transactions, which in and of itself would raise hundreds of billions of dollars? I think there are real problems with the bill in terms of who is in charge and the fact that this bill gives sweeping, vast, and unprecedented power to Secretary of Treasury Henry Paulson, who is himself a former CEO of Goldman Sachs from Wall Street. And that, you know, it's really wrong to put so much power in the hands of very few people, including those who actually helped create the problem to begin with. I think there's a problem in terms of who owns or controls the companies that are going to be requesting this assistance from the government, and the fact that there's only a very limited ability for the taxpayers through the government to get even non-voting shares of companies that we're supplying all this money to, when in fact we should be allowed to get voting shares so that we can help control these companies if in fact we're giving them such a big stake to bail them out. The issue of CEO compensation, I mean, they say a little bit has been done about that, but again, very little and very non-binding. There needs to be strict limits on CEO compensation, no loopholes in this bill for anyone's getting a bailout, and that's not in there either. Now, those are a few of the things that they got wrong in this bill. There are other things that are just completely missing, and these are major things. One of them is re-regulation. A major cause of the problems that we're seeing in the financial market is the near complete deregulation of this industry that's happened over the past 20 or so years. And, you know, there's suggestions in the bill that, oh, we'll set up a panel and we'll look at regulation after we bail them out. Well, guess what? after you've taken the bad assets off of their hands, it really decreases the likelihood that any serious re-regulation is going to happen. Serious help for homeowners is missing in this bill. There's nothing about a moratorium on foreclosures. There's nothing about bankruptcy reform. There's nothing to compel banks to renegotiate loans. And as I'm sure your listeners know, another big problem at the current crisis is the millions of home foreclosures that are going on across the country right now. So unless that problem is taken care of, this bailout, even if it goes through, might not really help anything because, you know, people will continue to foreclose, loans will continue to go bad. And then the final thing I would say that's completely missing from this bill, and again, pardon me from going on, but you get a sense of, you know, how complex it is that there's no real investment in Main Street. You know, and it's we don't need a bailout of Wall Street. What we need is investment in Main Street and reform of Wall Street, even if that includes some money that goes to loosen up the credit markets. But, you know, if you're going to plow up to $700 billion into banks, then you have to wonder, well, what kind of money is left for the government to start, for instance, a major stimulus package that focuses on moving our country from a fossil fuel-based economy to a renewable energy economy, which is a major plank of my platform and something that would create millions of new jobs. And, you know, wouldn't that help the economy, creating all those jobs, just as much as giving these banks money to cover for their reckless behavior? So that's, you know, that's just sort of a list of the major highlights, but there are just so many things wrong with this bill, and I think most Americans get it, and that's why they're so upset, and that's why they're so upset at Chris Van Hollen and other people who voted for it. And if I can just add one final thing here, and then I'll stop again. One of the reasons I believe that Chris Van Hollen has voted for this bill is that he's taken more than $33,000 from the securities industries in just this past election cycle. And as the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, he's raised more than $5 million from the securities industry in just this past election cycle. Now, once again, I think most people understand that's a basic conflict of interest. And they have reason to be concerned that someone who's so beholden to these people for the money they're giving him is not going to control them or regulate them or come down on them the way that needs to happen right now. So I think those are some of the major dynamics in the financial bailout bill that desperately need to be addressed if it's going to have any positive effect at all or gain the support of the majority of the American people.
Well, I think, Gordon, people do understand and know that if they hear about it. And the question is, what do they hear? I would love for the answer and the explanation you just gave to be something that we hear on CNN and MSNBC and the broadcast networks, and yet I doubt very much they're ready to put you on, and if they do, you get 8 seconds. And so there is a problem there. But our listeners seem to be excited, and the chat room is filling up with questions, and we've got callers
Great.
On the line I want to get to. So let me give out a couple of numbers. If you want to call in with your questions for Gordon Clark, who is running for Congress as a Green Party candidate in the 8th District of Maryland, call toll-free 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494, outside of the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350. And let me just add that in less than an hour, the United States Senate is about to vote on this bailout, not the reasonable sort of plan that Gordon has just suggested, but a horrible one made worse with further tax cuts. Call both of your senators and then get right back to listening to this program. Call 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121, or go to afterdowningstreet.org. Let's go to Scott from Canada with a question for Gordon Clark.
Hello, Mr. Clark. First off, I'd like to say thank you for running. A lot of people complain. Very few people stand up, see a positive vision, and go after it. But
thank you.
Speaking to that positive vision, I'm going to talk about your economic models in terms of going to community-based economies. And I'm wondering, can you do that without exiting the fiat system to a certain degree by establishing things within the communities like community services barter banks to where citizens could exchange goods, services amongst themselves in a local area without having to rely on centralized financial systems?
Fantastic question. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a big part of the solution. And clearly it won't be easy moving from the system we have now to one that's much more local, although, you know, frankly, in almost any area that we look at, and, you know, the energy crisis is certainly another big one of them that I talk about and work on. It's another one where we need to talk about going local. And the things that you're talking about, certainly barter communities, even something like local credit unions. We should have so many more credit unions in this country than we do right now. Because again, I think what I think people are really looking for now is a way that they can invest their money and make sure that it does in a local bank or a local institution, make sure that it doesn't get mixed up in some, like, you know, shenanigans going on up in Wall Street so they lose everything. And the type of stuff that you're talking about, and again, things like credit unions, local banks, commercial banks that are strictly limited from doing work with investment banks, those are precisely the types of models that we need to start moving towards to make for a much healthier economy. And just to add one point to that, and this is another part which frankly no one is talking about right now, it is downright scary to see the consolidation that's going on with the banking industry, because it's going in the exact opposite direction that it should. I was speaking with a good friend of mine who actually works in commercial lending and commercial real estate, and unfortunately he's been out of work for 8 months because of the current situation. He's freaked out about what's happening, that, you know, all these different banks are being bought out, so we might end up with a situation where there are only like 3 or 4 major national banks in the entire country. That is once again a recipe for disaster. And it's exactly this type of thing. You've heard this phrase mentioned over and over about, oh, we had to save this company because it was too big to fail. It had its hands in too many things. Well, that's what should be prevented. We shouldn't let companies get so big that if they do these shenanigans, they have to be bailed out or else they bring down half of the economy. So frankly, it's, you know, what you're saying is exactly the way we need to go. And one of the things that's scary about the current situation is that the banking industry seems to be going in the opposite direction right now.
Again, Gordon Clark, this is a point that needs to be heard more in Washington. I want to ask about the district just over to the east of where you are, which has a new Congresswoman, Donna Edwards, who did vote against this bailout in the House. But it seems to me that when she was running, and she ran twice, and ran as a Democrat in the primaries against a very corporate Democrat Congress member, Al Wynn, not too different, I think, in performance from Chris Van Hollen. And after she nearly beat him the first time around, he became the best social justice, peace, populist Congress member we've ever seen, showing up at all the peace rallies, demanding to speak. Nobody knew who the heck he was. First Congress member to sign on for new bills for impeaching the president and so forth. Completely switched him around. Now she beat him, and she immediately backed off on impeachment, took 3 steps back on peace, and so forth. She may have been doing us more good nearly beating him than beating him. But my question to you is, have you had any impact of that sort on Chris Van Hollen's performance yet? If not, do you hope to? And why did you choose to run as a third-party candidate rather than in the primaries?
Well, the two questions. One, if I had that sort of impact on Chris Van Hollen yet, I can't claim that I've had that sort of impact, and of course we haven't even had the election yet. So, you know, if we're going to put a scare into him, if he's going to see that, you know, 30,000 people or 50 or 100,000 people in his district won't vote for him anymore because of what he's been doing, we need to get to election day. However, I can say that we've had enough pressure on him that he has actually consented to participate in a public candidate forum, which is in fact happening tomorrow night. And that is extremely unusual for a multi-term incumbent member of Congress to consent to participate in a public forum, let alone the one that has a third-party candidate in it.
That's, you know, terrific. Specifically, do you know the time and place?
Yeah, absolutely. It's at 8 o'clock. It's at 7 p.m. tomorrow. It's from 7 to 8:30, so it ends before the vice presidential debate. It's at 7 p.m. tomorrow. It's happening at the Rockville Library in Rockville, Maryland. And if people want to go to our website, again, at clarkforcongress.net, they can get complete information on it. So I think that's one sign already that he's, you know, coming under some pressure. He's having a lot of different groups and individuals who are saying, you have to debate these issues. And I think he's bowing to that. So that's certainly some progress. But in terms of, you know, continuing to make that progress, I mean, the point that I think you're making, which is so key to why I've run, is that, you know, for all the great advocacy work that David, I know you do, and After Downing Street does, and Peace Action, the groups that I've worked with have, unless candidates, unless incumbents in Congress feel fundamentally challenged with their jobs, they will not change. And it's frankly, it's no different. I mean, there are employees. And this is no different. I talk to people who run businesses or are managers. You know, if you have an employee and they're not doing what you want, well, what do you do to correct their behavior? You talk to them, you write memos, you do whatever. Well, and if they still don't change, what do you do? Well, ultimately, you fire them. And if you're not willing or able to fire them, then guess what? That employee is never really going to change. So I think that's something that, you know, the left in this country, which I realize has a lot of distaste for electoral politics, and I think that's, you know, there are good reasons for that. But unless we can engage fully in electoral politics as sort of the twin arm of our advocacy work, unless we can put serious electoral pressure on these incumbents who aren't doing what we want, they don't have any reason to ever do what we want. And that's a lesson that I think I'm learning anew every day as I'm out and campaigning. And, you know, that's our job here. And that's why I say our goal is to really change the representation of this district. And whether that happens because I win or because I win the next time around or because the current incumbent sees, oh, my God, people are really upset with me and they're voting for this other guy, so I have to do something different. All of those are ways to change the representation, but they only come about when we participate in electoral politics.
Well, I assume that your name's on the ballot, and managed to get yourself into a debate. So these are huge steps that are barriers to candidacies all over the country. Another one, of course, is the media. Can you talk about how the local media in Maryland, which there includes the Washington Post and D.C. media, has dealt with, if it has at all, your campaign and how more independent and smaller media outlets have behaved?
Well, smaller independent outlets have in fact been very receptive. One that you know we particularly like here, it's the Tacoma Park and Silver Spring Voice. It's a smaller paper, but it does get out to a lot of people. They've been very open to talking to me, to be printing information about the campaign. You know, when you go then to the larger media, and there are, you know, there aren't too many different, you know, media outlets, at least in terms of print in this area. Yeah, then you are talking about the Washington Post. And as your listeners might not be surprised to hear, as a very mainstream and very corporate media outlet, they ignore third-party candidates. You know, as a general rule, they also ignore races where they don't think, you know, it's like it's unclear who's going to win. And if they think a race, you know, someone is obviously going to win, then they might not even bother. But they're actually antagonistic, you know, some of the editors there, you know, we've heard quotes, are openly antagonistic towards third-party candidates. And, you know, in a way, it's like they talk, you know, people say, oh, this paper's in the tank for Obama or this paper's in the tank for McCain. Well, the Washington Post and the mainstream media generally seems in the tank for the two-party duopoly. And even though they'll, like, complain about things that are happening and you know, say they're talking about issues, they're unwilling to cover candidates who are actually presenting alternative positions on these issues. So obviously that's very frustrating, and it's not anything we didn't know going into this race. And what that means is we have to work, you know, 2 and 5 and 10 times as hard in terms of reaching out to people, going to local festivals, knocking on doors, being at metro stations, shaking hands, you know, being on shows like yours, doing everything that we can to get the word out because we can't depend on the mainstream media to do it for us.
Yeah, and it's stands out rather sharply this week as they complain about people interfering in our democracy. Well, both parties and both presidential candidates are on the side of the bankers, and they are going to go absolutely nuts if the Senate votes the right way.
I got to add one comment on that, I mean, which is exactly what you're saying here, but on one of the local radio stations, they were talking about what happened in the House. And they said, well, you know, is the problem here that, you know, some of these representatives just caved to popular opinion in their district? And I just thought that was the most fascinating way to put it, because, like, isn't that called representing your district? I mean, since when is that called caving to actually do what your constituents want you to do? But I think that points out what you're saying.
Have the backbone and the principle to ignore people or to ignore polls,
exactly,
as sometimes put it, and stand unmovably by the list of positions you held years ago when you were elected, as if you could have had a position on everything like this. But we have to get to a break very soon, and I want to get in at least one question from our chat room. So let me give you this one from Jack in Michigan. As the Green Party intends to promote social justice and equal opportunity, and given we know that language plays a role in forming opinions in people's point of view, what is the stand on freedom of speech, and where are those boundaries drawn?
Well, that's a pretty big question and a pretty general question. I'm not sure, you know, that any boundaries need to be drawn on freedom of speech. I mean, other than the clear things of, you know, like you don't yell fire in a crowded theater, but I certainly can't think of any boundaries on freedom of speech that I think are necessary or even appropriate. And you know, back to what we just said a moment ago, I think the real problem is that there is not enough free speech in this country, that there are not enough venues you know, in any form of media, for people who have alternative positions to progressive or otherwise to be able to speak out. So I'm for more speech. The more speech, the better at this point, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let me add a twist. There are some countries and some international treaties that ban war propaganda, that ban, you know, fraudulent information to push a nation toward war. What's your position?
Well, if we had laws like this and laws like that in this country, I can think of at least a couple wars we wouldn't be in right now. you know, clearly it's terrible. I mean, you know, and, David, I read your emails, David, just so you know. After Downing Street puts out great stuff, and you know, you've made the point over and over again about the 932 lies, I think was the correct number, you know, that the Bush administration repeated to get us into this war in Iraq, lies that went, by and large, unchallenged by anyone in the mainstream media. And that's the reason that, you know, people, you know, believe this stuff when, in fact, there's not even an opposition party, let alone a critical media that's going to say, hey, that's not true. So, boy, I think laws like that would be fantastic in this country.
So maybe there are some appropriate limits on freedom of speech. Let's let everybody think about that, and we will take a break for some messages and be back for the second part of the program with Gordon Clark, who is running for Congress in Maryland's 8th District, and you can go to clarkforcongress.net to read about him, or if you're in the D.C., Maryland area, go hear him tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Rockville Library. This is thepeoplespeakradio.net. This is David Swanson, and we will be back in just a few minutes.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please give to the World Food Program.
We used to write letters to each other a lot, and it was intimidating to talk to him sometimes because
just seemed so isolated by himself.
She started talking about how she wishes that her life was over and she wishes that she was never born.
So I knew he had depression, but I didn't know it was that far.
Said something to me about killing himself.
Tell somebody, tell an adult, counselor, parent, whatever.
It's a hard situation because you do risk making that person very angry and losing their friendship.
It would have been horrible for me if she never talked to me again, but I'd live with it because I know she'd be alive.
Definitely worth getting help, even if you think you're going to lose a friendship, because it's better to lose the friendship than the actual friend.
Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teens. For more information, contact the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 888-333-AFSP, or online at afsp.org.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to EarthShare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson. Join us in the chat room at thepeoplespeakradio.net. Call in toll-free at 888-228-4494, and we are speaking with Gordon Clark, who is a candidate for Congress from the Green Party in the 8th District of Maryland, and we have callers on the line. Let's go to Mike in California. You are on the People Speak Radio.
Thank you very much. I heard you guys speaking earlier about a third-party candidate who ran against someone and seemed to straighten that candidate up, even though she lost. You know, I mean, it kept that candidate... Actually change their views and policies. I'd like to see the same thing done on a presidential level. You know, why aren't any of the Green Party candidates or Ralph Nader or anyone else invited to those debates? I'm thinking it's because they might actually present a real tangible solution for things like the economy. What do you think?
That was a Democratic candidate we were talking about earlier, but it's a good question. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, and thank you, Mike. I think your point is right on target, and that's precisely why people like Ralph Nader or Cynthia McKinney are kept out of the debates, because it would make the two mainstream candidates not necessarily look so good and would make a lot of people start scratching their head and say, wait a second, who do I want to vote for? You know, it's instructive to know that the League of Women Voters, which used to, as some of your listeners might know, League of Women Voters used to be the ones who organized the presidential debates. And then when the mainstream parties got together and decided after the 1980 election, that they didn't really want to have third-party candidates on the stage or that made them too uncomfortable, and they put pressure on the League of Women Voters, who actually then bowed out and said, well, listen, we are not going to run debates under these ridiculous rules that you're asking of us. And that's the point at which this Presidential Commission on Debates got set up, which is purely and wholly a product of the two mainstream political parties. And their goal, frankly, in a lot of ways, is to keep anyone other than from a Republican or a Democrat from speaking on that stage. It's fantastic that we have the media, the online stuff that we do, so that people like Ralph Nader and Cynthia McKinney and even Bob Barr and others can, you know, actually get their views out there. But it definitely isn't the same as being invited to the debates. And it's frankly, it's hard to call us anything close to the greatest democracy in the world when we only have two choices, or at least the mainstream media only presents us with two choices. As I like to say, you know, if we only had two choices of TVs or only had two choices of cereal, you know, there would be riots in the street. Yet for some reason we become convinced that, you know, we can only have two choices for political office. And I think that's one of the reasons that you know, we're having the bad policies and the ever worsening policies that we're getting. So absolutely, the debates have got to be opened up, and third-party candidates who are legitimate, as the ones I mentioned are, have party backing or have, you know, large-scale backing throughout the country. They absolutely need to be allowed into the debates.
It's an interesting history, Gordon, of the League of Women Voters and the two parties. In my understanding, this election cycle, just recently up in the state of Maine, the League of Women Voters has tried to hold debate limited to the two party candidates for the Senate, and the university where they tried to hold the debate has said, no, we won't hold it unless you let other party candidates in. So that position seems to have perhaps infiltrated the League of Women Voters. But it strikes me that it would be absolutely remarkable perhaps to see your debate tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Rockville, Maryland Library, but also to see a debate like the one we just saw between Obama and McCain with candidates like Ralph Nader, Cynthia McKinney, and others in there, because we saw some good pushback from Obama against McCain positions, but a huge amount of I agree with you, John. I agree with that. And throughout the thing, where I was screaming, I don't agree with either one of you. And we're going to have a debate late tomorrow night for the vice presidential nominee, where the whole contest appears to be focusing around who's smart enough to answer a question in a grammatically sane sentence. But the problem is when you get to positions, am I going to agree with the key positions the guy takes?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, that's you know, a huge part of what's wrong with our country, that, you know, we have these two mainstream political parties who, to an extremely significant degree, are getting their money from exactly the same corporate interests, and they're pushing, in a lot of ways, exactly the same positions and policies. Now, you know, they will try, I'm not saying they're completely the same, because they're not, and, you know, but there are other areas where they're trying to, like, invent differences that don't actually exist or come up with little minute things, because otherwise it would be, as you were noting, you know, in the debate last Friday, well, I agree with you on that, I agree with you on that, I agree with you on that. You know, we need to have someone up on stage who's going to say that the war in Iraq is not only wrong, but it needs to be ended, not just downsized. It needs to be ended. We need to have someone on the stage in these debates who's willing to say that, you know, the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan will make terrorism worse. It doesn't need to be expanded, as both candidates agree. It needs to be ended. We need to have someone on the stage who says, you know what? People in these countries, they don't hate us for our freedoms. They hate us for our airstrikes. And until we can come up with a policy that doesn't focus on military invasion and domination and come up with a policy that's focused on reconstruction and economic aid, we will never make progress in stopping terrorist threats against the United States or in repairing U.S. image around the world, which has been so terribly damaged over the past several years. So, yeah, you know, on any number of issues, it would be just a wonderful breath of fresh air to have third-party candidates allowed up there on the stage in the debate. It's got to happen. It's got to happen.
Well, tomorrow night's debates, the more painfully embarrassing one may be the one with Sarah Palin in it, but the more interesting one may be the one in Rockville. If at clarkforcongress.net, there's a link on the right that says Clark versus Van Hollen on the issues and lists a dozen major issues on which the two of you have opposite positions. We've got callers on the line and questions in the chat room, and let me take one of those first because it's from the great state of Maryland. Don in Maryland says, I originally supported Dennis Kucinich for president, and I've been following him on his assessment and solution for this economic crisis. I wish he had a bigger voice in this country. Who are you supporting for president? And, of course, Kucinich is no longer running for president.
Although you can always write him in if you want.
Sure you can.
I'll tell you what, for a couple of reasons, including the sanctity of the secret ballot and the fact that I'm really focused on the race that I'm running, I don't think it's appropriate for me to talk about who I might be backing or voting for in the presidential race. I think, frankly, there's more than one exciting choice this year. And I think it's also true that even though there are people like, you know, one candidate who I can think of who I might not vote for, but who has inspired a lot of people and given hope to people. And, you know, one thing that I try not to do as I'm running is to destroy people's hopes. I try to steer them in the right direction, to point out what the policies need to be, and to focus on the campaign that I'm running, you know, to say, here's something where we can make a real difference. But for a variety of reasons like that, I don't generally tell people who I'm supporting for president. I think any of your listeners can probably figure out in terms of what my positions are and the things I'm talking about, you know, who I might vote for, but I don't think it's appropriate for me to actually just, you know, talk about that on the air.
And you live in the state of Maryland, and in our corrupt electoral system, it's winner take all in any given state, and Maryland is voting for Obama for president.
There's no question, you know, that he will win this state and handle it. Yeah.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation with Gordon Clark, a congressional candidate from the Green Party in the 8th District of Maryland. Let's go to Mark from Atlanta. You are on the People Speak Radio.
Can you hear me? Radio check over?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
I was wondering what the guest feels needs to be done in order to get the people in our movement more active and off of the internet and out into their communities, because I think that, we certainly hold a lot of weight on the internet in terms of, you know, the way we managed to shatter the conventional political paradigm in exposing the bipartisan sellout and that sort of thing. The average person that I encounter, out on the street, you know, when I'm, not on the internet, they have this perception, as erroneous as it is, that just because somebody's a Democrat, that they're part of the real opposition. And obviously, you know, that's something that we need to overcome. And I was wondering, like, what your guest thinks about ways to mobilize people and to get them active, you know, not just on the internet, but out in the real world?
It's a good question, and Gordon, I might add, when your campaign is over, win or lose, will you have organized a group of people that will go on to work on anything?
Well, the answer to that question is heck yeah, and you know, that's, I mean, I'm an organizer, that's what I've been doing all my life, and this is really no different. You know, organizing people is the key to making any real change, and something that I heard from a college student whose class I spoke to recently, which really inspired me, now I've got to see if I can remember it, he said, you know, the victory doesn't come in the end result, it comes in the struggle. And any time there is real struggle, change happens. And change is what we want. So clearly we're absolutely organizing people here, and we'll absolutely take that beyond this election, whether that means a larger group of people to organize for the 2010 election and to get a head start on that, or to work on other key issues. You know, be it global warming, energy production in this country, the war, et cetera. I appreciate the caller's question about distinguishing from the internet in terms of in the real world organizing. And that doesn't mean, of course, that organizing doesn't go over the internet. But I think as part of the general alienation, and atomization of citizens in this culture, I think too many people feel that, you know, they are making real change when they just sit in front of their computer screen and click a mouse. And, you know, that's basically just your entry-level stuff. You know, this is one of the things we talk about in terms of what's been called the pyramid of influence. If you're trying to get, you know, influence your member of Congress or other elected officials to do something, you know, signing an online petition or a paper petition, okay, it has an effect, but a very small one. But you get higher on the pyramid the more time you invest and the more personal your lobbying, if we can call it that, becomes. So that, you know, a phone call means more than simply signing a petition. A personal letter means even more than a phone call, and for you to actually go in and visit that representative or to, you know, meet them at a local event and talk to them in person, that has the greatest. So I think that speaks exactly to what your caller was saying in terms of, like, you know, sure, we can do the internet stuff, but people, we have got to get out there in the real world and actually start meeting and talking with people. I think, honestly, and, you know, what I see in terms of what I'm doing, you know, a lot of people, they turn the other way when you come to them. I think a lot of people are starved for the type of human interaction that is real organizing. You know, they're looking for people who want to come up and talk to them. And it isn't easy. I mean, I won't say it's easy, but I think it's both fundamental and absolutely crucial if we're going to create any fundamental changes in this country, that type of real on-the-ground organizing needs to happen. And there are no particular secrets. I mean, one thing I heard many years ago, there are no new ideas in organizing. There are only old ideas that work. So, you know, all the basic things that, you know, groups like the ones I've worked in and After Downing Street and others do in terms of mobilizing people, they are all great. And that's what's got to happen.
Well, it's a good answer, and I think your earlier statement regarding the need for hope is important too. And I think, you know, what happened on Monday in the House may energize some people, because for once Congress, at least momentarily, listened to us, which people were beginning to doubt was even a possibility. What happens now in the Senate and the House may shatter that impression in some people's minds. We've got a couple of minutes before we have to go. Let me therefore absurdly throw out a huge question that I've been wanting to ask, which is, you want to shift some of our priorities and our expenses from the military and wars to useful things like green jobs. And I'm wondering how much, because Dennis Kucinich, you know, has proposed about a 15% cut in Pentagon, and gotten himself dismissed as way far out of the mainstream on Capitol Hill, although Americans in polls have said they want at least twice that much cut out of the Pentagon. Lynn Wolsey and Barbara Lee in the Progressive Caucus want this sort of a shift, but haven't even dared to put a number on it at all. What sort of numbers could you put on what kind of spending we can shift from killing to living.
Well, I certainly think we're talking, I mean, I wouldn't try to put a specific percentage on it, but I certainly think we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. People need to realize, and I think too many don't, that when you put together Pentagon spending and the wars, the price of wars, just the current price of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have spent more than $4 trillion on war and war preparation just since 9/11. And we still can't even catch one tall guy who's hiding out in the mountains in Pakistan, if you want to talk about ineffective spending. So clearly, it's done nothing for us. In fact, it's made the situation worse for us around the world. It's probably created more terrorists than it's actually eliminated. So when you talk about the fact that we've spent more than $4 trillion on war and war preparation in the past 7 years, when you talk about the fact that the incurred costs from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan might total another $2.5 to $3 trillion, then I think it's very easy to say, you know what, we need to take a few $100 billion of that money and use it to convert from a fossil fuel economy to a renewable energy economy. And, you know, again, I think this is something that resonates with people. It's like, why is it that we can always find, you know, another $150 billion for the war, we can find $700 billion for a Wall Street bailout, but we can't find $200 or $300 billion for a strategic government initiative to invest in renewable energy, which we desperately need both for our energy needs, but also to confront the crisis of global warming, which we haven't talked about at all yet, but conceivably, I would say, could be the worst, the most dire crisis that we actually face right now, and no one's even talking about it at this moment. So, you know, whatever the exact number ends up being, clearly we need to move hundreds of billions of dollars from war making and move it into renewable energy development and the type of investment in our economy that will actually help, you know, create the future, the sustainable, healthy, livable future that we need in this country.
Well, we are going to have you back again to get into global warming and so many other topics, but we're going to have to leave it there for now, and people can find out more at clarkforcongress.net. If you're in the 8th District of Maryland or around, you can go to the Rockville Library tomorrow night at 7 o'clock for a debate, which ought to be extremely entertaining, and I hope the video will be online for those of us who miss it. And you can give your money, if you've got it, to a candidate for Congress who is not taking money from the usual corporate sources at clarkforcongress.net. You can also go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and fund this program, because we live on your donations as well. When you've accomplished that, do not forget, in the next half hour, call both of your senators at 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121. We do not want a banker's bailout. We want it filibustered. Monday night, St. John Hunt, the son of Howard Hunt of Watergate notoriety, will be on the People Speak Radio. And next Wednesday, my guest will be Vincent Bugliosi, who is a well-known prosecutor, put Charles Manson behind bars, wrote Helter Skelter, and wrote his current best-selling book, on which he is working, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Don't miss that next Wednesday night. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio. Gordon, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, David. Thanks so much for the opportunity and the plug, and I'd always be happy to come back and talk with you more. Thanks so much for everything you're doing.
Thank you, and good night to everyone. Back with you again next week.
All right. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you.